on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Azure runs out of addresses. It's Microsoft versus Microsoft. There's one Wi-Fi ring to rule them all. And oh, data breach. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 97, recorded June 30th, 2014. Dwayne Melanson, recovering from a data breach. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by SmartThings, the easiest and most affordable way to create a smart home. Protect and control your home from anywhere with no contracts or monthly fees. For 10% off any home security kit, visit smartthings.com/twit and use the code TWIT10 at checkout. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballas here, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. I'm afraid that Curtis Franklin and Brian Chi are away. They told me that they just don't like you anymore and they never want to see you again. Seriously, they're on vacation. They'll be back next week. Let's get right into the news. Blip one, in the first of what is sure to be many litigious offspring of the Supreme Court's decision against Aereo, Fox is now using the case against Dish Network in order to, well, strengthen their already in progress legal battle over the latter streaming content to their customers over the internet. Though supporters of the broadcast networks were just a week ago assuring the public that the case against Aereo was only about the illegal rebroadcast of unlicensed copyright material and that it would not affect consumer choice or the growth of services on the internet, it's interesting to note that Dish is licensed to broadcast that content and that the suit against them is solely because they decided to offer that same content over the internet. Oh, hey, Facebook users, have you recently felt a bit more angst-ridden than normal? Well, it may not have been you. It might have been Facebook manipulating your brain. That's right. In an experiment that it conducted earlier this year, Facebook injected the feeds of nearly 700,000 of its users with negative content to see if that would make the posts that they wrote more negative. The researchers believe that it did. The mood of the posts seen in the news feeds of the experiment subjects moved like a contagion into the posts of the said subjects. The paper appeared in the Proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences, and Facebook has responded to sheepstorm criticism and indignation of the study by essentially saying, meh. Also, Cisco wants a bigger piece of the collaboration pie. Last week, the networking giant announced that they acquired Assemblage, a firm that specializes in browser-to-browser collaboration tools with no installation footprint. In a post on their blog, Cisco explains that Assemblage is part of their mobility-slash-cloud and Internet of Everything strategy. Since Assemblage's technology requires no downloads, plugins, or installations, it sounds like a perfect complement to Cisco's hardware-centric approach to communications. And finally, the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, or IC3, which becomes ICE, in leet speak, is warning businesses against a man-in-the-middle email scam that is now making the rounds. Using a spoofed email to request wire transfer payments for goods and services delivered, this man-in-the-middle scam is essentially a version of the old Nigerian email scam that specifically targets businesses that deal with overseas suppliers. While the losses have been relatively few since this is a scam, the losses have been higher per business scammed. There are now at least three companies that have fallen victim to the ploy to the tune of $1.65 million. The FBI has been working the case and have now tracked back the IPs of the original emails to, where else? Nigeria. Now let's get on to the Enterprise Bites. I welcome to the show Joseph Panettiere, the tech media entrepreneur who is also an official co-host of Tech News Today. Joe, thank you for coming back on the show.
Padre, thanks for having me back.
Now, we've got a couple of interesting stories to cover. You feel like doing some tech news?
Yeah, I'd love to do some tech news. What do we want to start with? You want to talk a little bit about Windows Azure, the cloud, IP version 4 or 6?
That's a good place. Let's start with that because, you know, for a while now, we've been knowing that the IPv4 cloud is falling. The sky has been going to crush us, and we should switch to IPv6. In fact, one of the biggest proponents of IPv6 was Microsoft itself, saying, look, businesses, if they're going to be responsible, they should start moving over their IT plants to utilize IPv6. Well, guess what? A few weeks ago, Microsoft ran out, well, sometimes, of IPv4 addresses for their Azure server. Now, according to the Microsoft blog post, their Azure cloud services have become popular to the point in which they can no longer consistently feed U.S.-based services with U.S.-associated IPv4 addresses. They've resorted to stealing non-U.S.-associated IPv4 addresses for some U.S.-based services during times of, as they say, dynamic situation. In one documented case, Yahoo users in the United States found themselves looking at the Brazilian portal in Portuguese because of geolocating cache. Now, Joe, I got to ask you here. Why in the world isn't Microsoft using IPv6 for Azure?
That is the question of the day, isn't it? And, you know, let's just up the ante. You know, what's been interesting here is you don't see a lot of other big cloud service providers poking fun at Microsoft, because I think a lot of Microsoft's rivals in the cloud are guilty of this same, I don't want to call it a crime, but come on, folks. Can we get to IP version 6, please?
You know, it's so strange, because Microsoft was one of those voices saying, oh, yeah, we're dual stack for everything. I mean, Windows, of course, we support IPv6 and all our services are IPv6. And if you're responsible, you move to IPv6. So it was strange, because when I first read this news, the first thought that went into my mind was, wait, they're still using IPv4? Now, okay, to be fair, it does kind of make sense, because there are some services out there that specifically want IPv4 addresses. Most of the services are dual stacked in some way, so it's not as if it's impossible to reach those services. It's just it's impossible to reach them with an IPv4 address that's assigned to the U.S. Now, here's another question for you, Joe. This is actually a not insignificant problem for Microsoft. They've been pushing Azure really, really hard. In fact, just a month ago at TechEd 2014, which Curtis Franklin was at, he could actually tell us about this next week, they were saying Azure is the future of Microsoft. They're saying we're doing everything in the cloud. We're pushing everything into the cloud. So to have this happen so soon after that big push, it's kind of embarrassing, no?
Yeah, I think it's embarrassing. And you know what? Another push will be coming. Don't forget, you got the Microsoft Worldwide Partner Conference coming up in July. And without a doubt, this whole cloud first message will come through loud and clear there. And remember, Microsoft attracts thousands of channel partners to that annual conference. And I think what you're going to hear is historically, Microsoft has spoken most about Office 365 at that conference as part of a cloud strategy. Now you're going to hear much more about an Azure partner program and a big push in the enterprise. So you're exactly right. Microsoft's making this big push already. It was at TechEd. Now we're going to get another wave of it at Microsoft Worldwide Partner Conference. So they better get their story straight with IP version 4 versus version 6 and which portions of their cloud stack support what.
Right. We've got Scott Michaud in the chat room who's saying that Epic Games, a gaming company, has added IPv6 into their Unreal Engine as of this last June 4th. So I think if a gaming company can do it, a company that makes most of its income off of the internet probably should as well. Now, one last bit of conversation I want to have with you, Joe, is there has been talk with this recent reluctance of one of the software giants to switch over entirely to IPv6, that perhaps some of the other IPv4 alternatives, the super NATing and the individual like regional NATing of IPv4, might start to gain a little bit of credibility as a option, as a alternative to IPv6. I mean, yes, we know we're out of IPv4 addresses, but it looks as if the scenario that people were playing out, that once we ran out of IPv4, all business would run to IPv6, just isn't happening. Do you think this lends credence to it at all? I mean, the fact that Microsoft didn't say, when they announced this problem, they didn't say, oh, and by the way, we're switching everything over to IPv6, but rather they said we're looking at technical solutions. It seems to me as if even this giant is saying, we're not ready to let go of 4 yet.
You know, it reminds me a little bit, if you rewind a couple of decades, you remember when Ethernet was running out of bandwidth, so to speak, and everyone was thinking about things like ATM, asynchronous transfer mode, and making that big leap. Well, it turns out that leap never happened. What we did was we went to switched Ethernet, fast Ethernet, gigabit Ethernet. So it was much more of a gradual path forward rather than a radical path forward. And I think that's what Microsoft and others are wondering right now. Can we make a much more evolutionary move rather than a revolutionary move? And we'll see how that plays out.
Right, right. And then, we've got the rivals. We've got Amazon with cloud compute. We've got Rackspace with their IPv6 offerings. Mm-hmm. Even Google is pushing into the IPv6 space with all of their online offerings. It will be interesting to see whether or not Microsoft will be dragged along kicking and screaming. Who knows? Let's jump on to the next Enterprise Byte, and that's about one Wi-Fi to rule them all. Yeah, this is sort of a hometown story, which is why I wanted it in the doc. The California cities of San Jose and San Francisco have announced that they are linking their free public Wi-Fi networks so that users can seamlessly transit from one system to the next. Now, the two cities, which are actually separated by an hour drive, will be using the Hotspot 2.0 standard to offer a single 5-minute sign-up that will allow users to either use the San Francisco or the San Jose system without further setup or configuration. Now, Hotspot 2.0 is a standard that has been developed to make Wi-Fi more like cellular communications. You know how your cell phone jumps from one tower to the next? This is supposed to mimic that functionality where your Wi-Fi connection will jump from one AP to the next, one network to the next, without needing to reconfigure, without needing to re-authenticate. Now, it only works for iOS and OS X technologies at the moment, but they are expanding it to Android and Windows in the near future. Joe, I wanted to bring this up to you because there are more and more models that are like this, which is we no longer want to be a singular Wi-Fi island. We want to be part of a bigger network, which we think will draw you to us. Do you see this as a trend that will continue?
Well, Padre, I have a surprise for you. You're going to like this one. About 7 years ago, give or take, I worked for a media brand called Muni Wireless, Municipal Wireless. At the time, what we covered was cities going to Wi-Fi and public broadband. Great topic. And back then, we ran a few conferences, and one of our theories back then was, yeah, as you go from San Francisco to San Jose and then even down to LA, wouldn't it be nice if you could do some Wi-Fi hopping and basically maintain all of your system configurations and everything else and move from one Wi-Fi network to the next? And those systems never really materialized because we had a few setbacks when it came to cities rolling out Wi-Fi, number one. Some of the projects actually went bankrupt or went belly up. And number two, we saw the rise of free Wi-Fi at Starbucks, at Mickey D's, McDonald's, of course. So I think it'll be interesting to see whether this it's almost this wave two of municipal wireless that's gaining some momentum now. And I would love to see this ubiquitous access offered. But I think I think we're still dealing with islands, Padre. I really do. I really think that each city is still trying to get Wi-Fi right before we can even hope to jump from one city to the next without these changes happening.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I've noticed about the system is it's kind of a nightmare for IT managers. As an IT person, I like the idea of having Wi-Fi networks that are connected. So I have a single set of credentials that can jump from network to network to network. And the cities love it because they think it's going to increase revenue. I mean, if you add a layer of convenience to anyone who might be visiting your city for business, there's premise to say that, yeah, that they'll spend more money, or yes, they'll do more business in our cities. Here's the problem, Joe. As an IT person, I have serious problems with an open network, an unencrypted network that uses authentication but depends on individual users to make sure they use some sort of encryption back to the enterprise. Where I see this being used is in BYOD, in mobile workers who are going to be connecting back to the office. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. most workers still don't use proper security protocol. Yes, it's more convenient, but to me, it almost seems as if it's now more convenient to bork your enterprise security. Is there any way to address that? I mean, this is one of those things. I tell people never log in from a public Wi-Fi access network. It's just not safe. But this is going to encourage more people to do just that.
I think it'll encourage that. Plus, you look at the cloud applications, Box, Dropbox, file sync, file sharing. And now, so they're going over public networks, and now they're using publicly available SaaS applications outside of the corporate firewall. And and yes, we could see a lot of problems going forward because corporate IT somehow has to clamp down.
Right. We've got Chibert in the chat room who should be on vacation but is here because he's a workaholic. But Chibert is saying, well, you know, those public networks never really handled the load well for him. So he always used LTE, his own LTE. And I know in San Francisco, there are actually a couple of enterprises right next to me that I can name off that have a policy of not allowing their users to log in over anything except the company-issued LTE modems that they give them. It's part of the issue. It's more expensive, but they figured since they can control the end-to-end security using the built-in encryption inside the dongle, that the inconvenience is worth it for the added security. Do you think we'll ever reach a point where the larger enterprises are just going to say, look, just no Wi-Fi, period? We will never allow you to connect if you're using anything that's even remotely public.
No, I don't think we will ever get there. I just think people who have devices now have an assumption of connectivity. And when that connectivity goes away, the employee goes away. So I don't think we'll ever get to the no Wi-Fi stage.
Yeah. Oh, well. All right. Let's move on to the next story. I mean, Wi-Fi is cool, but you know what's even cooler? When Microsoft beats up on Microsoft. Yeah, we've got a story here from Network World talking about how L.A. County was in the process of updating its systems to all on-premise Microsoft Exchange servers. Now, during this deployment, they halted it at 12 of 32 departments because they thought maybe it might be a good time to evaluate Microsoft Office 365. Now, they were able to evaluate 365 against the Exchange servers that they already deployed in those 12 departments. So this was a fair test, and the results, well, surprise them. The Exchange server deployment was part of an email platform unification that was started 3 years ago to get different departments using the same communications platforms and take advantage of the more advanced UCS features. Now, at the time of the planning, which again was 3 years ago, they looked at cloud offerings and they said, look, they're just not mature enough. They're not stable enough. I don't think we can trust them. We want more data. Now, 3 years later, they looked at it and they've realized, yeah, they're going to go with Office 365. Now, this is actually pretty big. I mean, L.A. County is huge. 32 departments in L.A. County is a big deal. And on-premise required, as they found out, costly migration services, storage hardware and policies, significant colo and disaster recovery cost, whereas they saw 365 as a way to pay one price, one licensing, and get all of that plus Office 365. Now, Joe, I want to throw this over to you because it seems to me that this is the strategy that Microsoft wanted to pursue all along, to make things so dead simple to put it in the cloud that people would finally say, oh, yeah, that's so much cheaper. Why aren't we doing that?
Yeah. You know, I don't know if the word is cheaper. I do know this. I think the key focus area is predictable. You know, governments, enterprise IT organizations, they all want predictable costs now. And they want predictable reliability, a predictable experience. And they're figuring out that out in the cloud, you can get those services far more predictably than you can on-premise.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the other big sell here was mobile and UCS. When they were looking at Office 365, they said, wait a minute. Exchange server gives us the predictability of having something on-premise, and that's always good. But if we go with Office 365, not only do we get all of that stuff taken care of for us, but we also get the much better mobile features of Office 365. We get the entire suite on mobile devices. We get the ability to access our data, the OneDrive from anywhere in the world. We get the ability to use it on iOS and Android and Windows Phone devices anytime we need to. So that was a big sell. But here's the thing I want to ask you. If this really was Microsoft's strategy all along, why is it that so many enterprise people still say that Microsoft's licensing policies are archaic at best and absolutely hurtful to sales at worst?
Yeah, you know, so let's talk about Microsoft and Office 365 licensing. And also let's bring up the big competitor, Google Apps. So I don't know what the current list is, but in terms of Microsoft and Office 365 and the SKUs, last I saw, I think there was roughly 11 different SKUs, maybe more. Completely confusing. Meanwhile, Google has one or two. So it's a very simple business model over at Google. And I think over time, Microsoft's going to have to simplify. The challenge Microsoft had when they were setting this all up was, I think they were trying to build revenue streams that somehow paralleled their existing Microsoft Office, Exchange, SharePoint businesses, et cetera. So they created all these crazy SKUs, and it has confused customers.
Yeah, I think it really has confused them. But even though the six SKUs is way more than, you know, two or three from Microsoft or from Amazon, but I got to say that's less than what it was a year and a half ago. I think we were at something like 18 SKUs. So they've definitely pared them down, but it still seems to me that they're not making it brain dead simple. It really should be, look, you can get server, Exchange server, you can have it on-premise, you can do everything yourself, you can handle all your hardware, or Bing, this. This is the enterprise version. This is 365. It's everything. That's all you have to know. Why does that not exist?
Yeah, I think the other challenge they have is they're trying to carve something out for their channel partners as well. Okay. And what they've been trying to do is trying to create some SKUs that appeal to channel partners that are selling into small businesses with up to roughly, I think, 200 or 250 seats. So you get one whole set of flavors in that market. And then once you get to 251 seats roughly and above, you get a whole different set of flavors. And increasingly, Microsoft wants to sell that direct, although there is some room for partners to play in that area.
Right. Joe, the cost advantages of putting something in the cloud versus on-premise, that's well known. I mean, people, anytime they talk about the cloud, they always talk about the cost savings. But something that Microsoft has been able to do, and I think this is kind of stealthy, is by bundling 365, not just with your email, but also with your productivity suite, they've now created something in the cloud that no one else can match. We're going to see this bundling from other manufacturers, right? I mean, we're going to have to see it from Amazon. We already kind of see it from Google. What kind of partnerships need to be made in order for these other entities to compete with Microsoft on cloud services?
You know, it's interesting. There's a few companies out there that I think are doing some intriguing things. Zoho would be one of them. Zoho has multiple different applications. They have their own online mall where you can just keep on clicking on applications to create bigger and bigger bundles. You know, I also think Amazon's at play here without a doubt. You know, what's challenging, I think, is a company like Amazon, they're trying to do desktop as a service, but they're offering Microsoft's own Windows through that desktop as a service in the Azure cloud. So on the one hand, Amazon's trying to free you of Microsoft. But on the other hand, Amazon itself is leaning on Microsoft, and the whole licensing challenge is there to move forward. The dark horse in here, I think, is IBM. I think they were way behind in the market. They were doing smart docs and some other initiatives. And then they got into the game with the SoftLayer acquisition. And we'll see, you know, SoftLayer right now, mainly infrastructure as a service. We'll see how IBM layers in software as a service on top of that in some big ways in the months ahead.
Yeah. Let's move on to another part of this, which is anytime we've talked about cloud services in the past, there's always been that reluctance to move because, dun, 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 what happens if you lose your connection, right? I mean, that's always been sort of the nightmare scenario. I move my entire enterprise over to cloud-based services, and then I lose my connectivity to the internet, and suddenly I've wasted an entire day or however long it takes for me to reestablish my connectivity. Now, just last week, just this past Tuesday, in fact, there was a breakdown that caused a system-wide outage of Office 365 across the world. That was the once nightmare scenario of Office connectivity of cloud services. Now, it pretty much decimated the workday for the East Coast. You had a little bit of productivity that you could still have on the West Coast because of the time shift, but you don't see this as a huge outcry. I mean, if this had happened 2 years ago, every story in the tech media would have been about the outage. This got maybe a day of play and a couple of afternotes, but it doesn't seem to be as big of a disaster as people first thought it would be. Why is there that difference?
Because I think so many people are using Office 365 now that they're getting used to how reliable it is. I think Office 365, Google Apps, Salesforce.com, and the list goes on. The track record is just getting better and better, and the deployments are getting wider and wider. So when you're used to those services always being up, The one time it's down, yeah, it's surprising, and you're going to have a day of non-productivity. But on the other hand, so many people are used to a good experience most of the time. I don't think there's a big outcry when it's going to be a dark day.
One last question, Joe, and that is, not too long ago, the city of L.A. was evaluating Google for the exact same thing, moving over to Google services because free, of course, is awesome. But they had some serious complaints about the potential security issues with using Google. Why do you think they're not going to have that with Microsoft? Because it seems as if that's not even a question anymore.
Yeah, you know, I also think that's a story that goes back in time when both Microsoft and Google were having some issues with quote-unquote security. And it's not like Microsoft or Google had documented security breaches in the cloud. The bigger issue was various verticals, government, financial services, healthcare. They have these various compliance mandates that the cloud services took a while to catch up with. It's sort of a checkmark box. Do you comply with this various mandate? And you've got to be able to check that box, yes. Now most of the major cloud services led by Google, led by Microsoft, are able to check off those boxes.
Yeah. Now, speaking of checking off of boxes, when we come back, we've got someone who thinks out of the box. We're going to be having Dwayne Melanson from Melanson. I'm sorry, there's a Cajun pronunciation there. Please put that into your head. From Tripwire, who's going to be explaining to us what you need to do to establish trust after a breach. But before that, I thought it might be a good time to talk about the first sponsor of the Twilight Riot. And of course, it's SmartThings. Now, if you've been watching developments in the connected home, then you've probably heard about SmartThings. They've made quite a bit of buzz in the last couple of months. SmartThings makes it easy to protect and control your home with your smartphone. You can adjust the lights or temperature, keep track of whether your kids come home from school on time, and even check to see if you remembered to close the garage door. And you can do it from anywhere using your iOS or Android device. Now, okay, enough of the PR talking points. I know you hear this about every home automation system. What makes SmartThings different? Well, I think what makes it different is that it's so easy. This is what you start with. This is their kit. You start with one of their three home security kits, which they call Smart, Smarter, and Smartest. And each kit contains one of this. This is sort of the brains of the system. This is the Smart Hub. Now, this smart hub allows you to connect to all of these sensors, all of these different devices, so that you can get functionality throughout your home. Now, what I really like is this one. This is the Smart Sensor Presence. This allows you your hub will know when you're actually in the house, when you're actually near your devices, and you can program it to turn things on and off depending on what kind of activities you plan on doing. You plug your SmartThings hub into your router, you add the sensors, the switches, and the outlets as instructed by the SmartThings app, then you enjoy remote control of all your things. Now, here's something else I really like. In addition to all these sensors, in addition to the motion sensor and the multi-sensor and the hub, you get to use the devices from some of the most popular home automation vendors currently on the market. The manufacturers like GE or Slage or Honeywell, Eon, as well as the latest connected devices from manufacturers like Nest, Philips, Wemo, and Sonos, and oh so much more. In other words, SmartThings works with the home automation you already have. It's compatible with your devices. It's just, well, smarter. Now, the Smart Home Security Kit is $329. It includes one SmartThings hub, one SmartSense motion sensor, one SmartSense presence sensor, and three SmartSense multi-sensors, which are multi-purpose sensors for doors, windows, and drawers that sense when things open and close and can measure temperature, acceleration, and vibration. The Smarter Home Security Kit is $479. It has all those things, plus an additional motion sensor, a smart power outlet, and a siren or strobe alarm. Now, the Smartest Home Security Kit is $599. It includes all of the above, plus another presence sensor, power outlet, and an outdoor light plug and control power outlet. Each of these kits offers an affordable way to secure and automate your home without any of the contracts, monitoring fees, or hidden charges associated with the traditional home security company. So here's what we want you to do. To get started today, to create your smart home, visit smartthings.com/twit. And you can save 10% off the purchase of any home security kit by entering the code TWIT10 at checkout. You'll also get free shipping within the United States. That's smartthings.com/twit. And remember to use the code TWIT10 at checkout. And we thank SmartThings for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We welcome to the show honored guest and all-around guru of all things reputation, Mr. Dwayne Melanson from Tripwire. Dwayne, thank you for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
So, Dwayne, you are the Chief Technology Officer at Tripwire. You've been doing this for 25 years. You've been giving presentations on reestablishing your reputation after a breach. You've been giving presentations on how to protect yourself from a breach or even how to diagnose how a breach happened. Tell me, what do we not know about breaches?
Well, one of the challenges when we step into a breach situation is that kind of those first questions, okay, do I have a problem? If I do, how big is it? And what do I have to do to recover and then prevent this from happening again? So a lot of the discussions, you know, kind of in the old days, when I first started getting involved in breach cleanup back in 2001, a lot of the questions were really centered in the IT realm. So the InfoSec guys, you know, maybe law enforcement, if law enforcement got involved. But what's changed over the last probably a couple of years in particular is that now the rest of the business is getting involved. You know, we're talking about reputational impact. We're talking about, you know, the board having confidence and trust in our information security capabilities and things like that. So when we talk about restoring trust, you know, there's the old school kind of technical conversation, but it's all the way up to, you know, what systems can I trust? Which third parties and providers can I trust? And then how do I rebuild the trust in our own capabilities so that we have the confidence to be able to defend ourselves and people, you know, whether it's our customers or internal employees, feel like we've got things under control?
Now, Dwayne, this unfortunately is a very common scenario where an enterprise will be breached, because all enterprises will be breached at some point in some way, in some fashion, and they don't know what to do. They kind of know that they want to fix what's going on the technical side, although what I've seen most often is that they just kind of reset everything. In fact, the single most common mistake that I think IT administrators will make after a breach is because they think their system has been compromised, they'll go back to backups and they'll wipe everything out in order to have a clean slate. But then they've wiped out all traces of the breach. They don't know how it happened. And in fact, if it was a problem with the network, with the way it was configured, they've just opened themselves to another breach. That's kind of been the MO for at least 20 years.
Yeah, that's the, you know, the just fix it thing. You know, throw a bunch of people at it, try to get it fixed. And one of the challenges there is that, as you were mentioning, you destroy evidence that could be used to kind of help figure out forensically what happened. But you're redeploying infrastructure that's vulnerable in the same way. So it's, you end up playing like this game of whack-a-mole where I redeploy something, I fix it, it's compromised again in the next few minutes, and it starts infecting the things around it, and you're never done. And one of the things we learned early on was that one of the quickest changes you can make that makes a difference is to, you know, we call it stabilizing the patient. So you remove or reduce access to the production environment, force password changes on all of the production credentials, and that includes service accounts, it includes third-party vendors, it includes anything that adds any kind of service or access to your network. So change all of those, because the attackers will probably have most of those credentials anyway. And you know, now you can start to do other things, like you want to implement a production change freeze, because the moment you expect things to be quiet, any motion will be an indication that something's up. You know, so you're now looking at, it could be a case of I've forgotten to turn something off, or someone has, you know, access to the email system, for example, or to one of our trusted repositories, and they're just, you know, scoping out the new credentials the moment we change them. But it helps you to try to narrow it down so that you're not trying to deal with everything at once.
Okay. Now one of the other issues here is when an IT person knows that his or her network has been breached, their first responsibility is to get it working again. Because, I mean, just because an enterprise has been breached doesn't mean you can shut everything down. People still need to work. Things still need to get done. So I can understand why their first inclination is to just reset everything, even if, as you said, that could be a horrible, horrible thing. Mm-hmm. If they're not to do that, if they're not to just wipe the slate clean and start from scratch so they can get back to business, how would you suggest that they proceed? I mean, what are the things that they need to do at the very beginning to make sure that they preserve evidence of the breach while at the same time getting people back to work?
Well, part of this is understanding ahead of time what you're dealing with. And that means, you know, having a clearer picture of what your risk tolerance is on different things. We talk about identifying what we refer to as the fragile artifacts. So these are the systems that are most important to your business because they either are revenue bearing or maybe they have a high business impairment cost if they go down. Or, you know, in some cases, it's just because nobody knows how to fix this thing anymore and we can't take it offline. You know, so for those things, if you have to leave them running, then you need to contain them. So that's, again, where you go back and say, how do I minimize the number of people who can access and make changes to this? How do I put really tight monitoring around these systems so that I know everything that's going in, everything that's going out? I can start to, you know, minimize the chances that people will misuse those assets in my environment. So that's a big starting point, is to understand what's most important and really focus your time and attention on putting as tight of set of controls around those things as you can, because chances are those are the things that will most harm your businesses, most harm your customers, and you know, get you into regulatory trouble. Whatever the issue is, chances are those fragile artifacts are at the center of that.
Okay, now before we get too much into the nitty-gritty, I want to take a step back and let you give us sort of a 10,000-foot view of the problem. Specifically, do you have any cases that you can talk about where a company was breached and then it had a particular response to that breach that maybe could use some improvement?
Well, some of this, there's this blurry line between response and planning. And one of the examples, and by the way, full disclosure, I'm not involved in the cleanup, so I can talk about this based on publicly available information. But if you look at the Target breach, for example, there are a lot of things that we can learn from that. You know, one is the evidence would indicate that there wasn't a lot of network segmentation going on, so that once someone got into the network, they were able to move around, you know, pretty much unimpeded. And that's one of the things that we've learned, is that the value of segmentation and compartmentalizing your network based on business function, business purpose, makes it easier to control that. Because if you know that a certain segment of the network only does a certain set of IT functions, then it's easy to find when exceptions happen. You know, so this is the outlier kind of a problem. One of the other things we found is that you need to safeguard your deployment repositories. You know, a lot of organizations are moving towards DevOps and other kind of rapid deployment methods, and those are awesome, but you've got to realize that they're a point of potential vulnerability, because anytime something, whether it's code or IP or even a transaction, moves from one set of one environment to another, you know, I call these the handoffs. Anytime one of these handoffs happens, risk is introduced. So you need to make sure that, you know, your release management guys released some things, put it into a trusted repository. Did it stay that way once they put it in? You've got scripts that take these payloads out and, you know, deploy them across your production environment. Can I trust those scripts? Have people been tampering with those? Because I've seen cases where, you know, somebody modifies a script and not only does it pull from your trusted repository, but it may pull from another directory on your network that you're not even monitoring. And, you know, those kinds of best practices will help you understand what is baseline normal for my environment, how do I detect the variants, and then more importantly, how do I safeguard those risky transitions from either, you know, staging to production or from release management into deployment repositories or wherever the, you know, kind of sensitive things are happening? How do I put some controls around that so that I know when somebody does something they shouldn't?
All right. Now, I'd like to welcome back into the conversation Joe Panettiere. Joe, this is something that we cover a lot, right? I mean, anytime there's a data breach, it's huge news. Anytime there's a data breach, there's always that sort of the forehead smacking moment of you did what? Or, you know, you didn't tell your customers fast enough. Or you allowed your customer base to be taken out unencrypted. Or you allowed your customers' credit card numbers to be compromised. So this is something that enterprises is really starting to pay attention to, right? I mean, it's no longer just trying to prevent a breach. It's now you're going to get breached. What do you do after?
Yeah, and I think as you both covered just a little bit during the opening of this topic, it's more of a business discussion now. There are business leaders now, rather than just the CIO, rather than just the VP of IT, who are making purchase decisions on SaaS applications, cloud applications. And all these business leaders ultimately need to be responsible, working closely with the CIO, I think, going forward. And maybe it's a chief compliance officer. Maybe it's one of the questions I'd like to ask is, are we going to see the return of a chief information security officer? You know, we saw that boom maybe 5 to 7 years ago, and then it died down a bit. You know, I'd put the question to both of you. Are we starting to see now that need for someone who is the point person ultimately for wrapping their arms around this?
Now, I do want to just really quickly address something that's going on in the chat room right now. There's sort of a mantra happening of trust no one. And that's a very common phrase here on Twit. We believe in trust no one, but we're not talking about that right now. We're not saying, oh, just make sure that just assume everyone is going to try to mess you over. Yes, keep doing that. But what we're talking about is if you're running a service, if you're running an enterprise, if you're running a business, in order for people to trust you enough to buy your services or products, there needs to be a level of reputation trust. There needs to be a level of brand loyalty, brand adherence. And that's – oh, thank you. Thank you, Brian, for that, bringing that in. That's very trustworthy. Oh, I'm sorry. Back to what I was saying. But that's what we're trying to repair. So once you've had that breach, how do you fix it? I want to go back over to you, Duane. Can we specifically talk about Target? Because I think that's the one that's freshest in people's mind. What happened? How did the breach occur? And how did they respond?
Well, it's very complex. But one of the things that happened was that credentials from a third-party contractor were used to gain access to the network. They were able to do some reconnaissance. They were able to access the cardholder environment, the PCI environment. They were able to poison the deployment repositories and get some malware deployed to all of the stores using Target's own automation systems. You know, so there are a lot of issues here. And there are things like, you know, good network segmentation would have kept people from with any credentials from accessing the POS environment without being noticed. You know, so having a very flat network can be a very bad thing because it allows people to just wander around and it makes it hard to tell what's going on. So that's one aspect of it. You know, I got to say, in their favor, they were actually very proactive in communicating. You know, so one of the challenges there, though, is that the moment you start to try to communicate and be transparent early, you're going to be wrong because we don't know a lot in the early days of these, you know, after a breach is discovered. There's a lot of investigation that needs to happen before you know the full story. And so one of the things that I urge people is to, you know, understand what your communication plan is ahead of time. Understand how you're going to communicate this, who the spokespeople are, so that you don't have speculation. Defer. If you don't have facts, don't. You know, you kind of reduce that tendency to speculate because speculation can get you into trouble. Because one of the things that will happen is it'll turn on you pretty quickly. You'll say, oh, we're very transparent. And then the moment you get new information and you change the response, people think, oh, well, you know, are they trying to deceive me? When in fact, you're just responding to new information. You know, so be very careful with how you respond publicly because, as you mentioned, trust is the issue here. And if people feel like you're being genuine and you're sharing, you know, it can go a long way. I think one company that did a great job of that was Zappos. They did a very credible job of responding, being transparent. You know, there was kind of in my audit world, we look for tone at the top. There was tone at the top, the president on down, consistent communications internally and externally. They didn't speculate. You know, they took the customer's interest to heart and manned the phones 24/7 to help people with account issues and, you know, potential account misuse. And, you know, to me, there are things to be learned on the positive side from people who have been victims of this in terms of how they communicate to the outside world.
Well, if I remember correctly, Zappos actually does have a chief security officer. What were the things that they did? I mean, going back to Joe's suggestion that we re-implement that position, is that what you need? Do you need a czar who is there for emergencies? That's pretty much all he deals with. He deals with the aftermath of breaches. Is that what Zappos did right? Is that what other companies should copy?
Well, and one of the things they did right was to plan ahead. You know, so this is the value of having standards and having a mandate that drives people to adhere, adopt, and conform to those standards. I mean, one of the challenges when a lot of these breach cleanups are so complicated because, you know, the servers have developed personalities and they're like snowflakes, and it's really difficult to tell which ones are configured properly, which ones are not. So having a set of standard applications, standard ports, standard configurations, and, you know, standard user set in a production environment in particular can all go a long way to help you root out the outliers very quickly and systematically. And Zappos actually had that capability. They also had some of the best practices that we've heard about in some of the breaches, right? Having salted and hashed passwords, ensuring that they had good role-based access control. And again, you don't want to have user identities like snowflakes. You want to have logical groups of capabilities. And when you provision users, you provision them based on their role, not on who they are. You know, so you have a bunch of people who move from one project to another and retain these vestigial access rights. You know, that even makes it harder. So a lot of this gets down to having a set of standards, having the means to set those expectations, hold people to the policy, detect outliers and exceptions early, and deal with them before they result in loss.
Right, right. Joe, let me drag you back into this conversation, because so what Dwayne is saying, I mean, it all makes sense. And it all seems as if, yeah, these are these things that you should have in place. Well, why is it that most enterprises don't?
I think Dwayne had mentioned earlier that this move to DevOps and this speed to market, this, you know, every corporation, particularly every publicly held corporation, their big, big priority is earnings per share and boosting revenue and growth. And how do you do that? You don't do it from IT maintenance. You do it from IT innovation. And I think sometimes companies get so caught up in how we innovating, they don't call a time out and take a hard look at their best practices, as Dwayne had shared.
Okay, Dwayne, let's go to those best practices. Okay, so here's our hypothetical 10,000-seat enterprise network. It's tied to a business that has some sort of retail operation. There's just been a massive breach. They're just starting to leak out reports to the press. What are the actions they need to take? What, I mean, if you were now the chief security officer and you're directing the troops and you're in this emergency mode, what do you tell them to do?
Well, I'll start with, if law enforcement's involved, you do what law enforcement tells you to do.
Okay.
But short of that, or even in cooperation with them, some of the logical steps that we see making sense are, first, you know, I mentioned stabilizing the patient. That's, you know, reducing access to the production environment, resetting those service accounts for everything, freezing changes, and then continuously monitoring the heck out of it so that any change gets noticed. You know, the other part of this is to know what you have and have it prioritized by risk and value. I talked about the fragile artifacts. You need to have that discussion ahead of time, ideally not in the kind of heat of firefighting with the breach. And that needs to be a business discussion, because you need to make trade-offs. You're not going to be able to deal with everything at once, and you need to have a good, consistent means of evaluating which things you're going to deal with, which ones you're not, which things are safe to take offline, which ones are not. And, you know, so that's a key aspect of it. The next area is where standards come in. You need to be able to figure out the difference between good configurations, bad configurations, good users and bad users. If you happen to have standards in place, or you've got a really robust deployment and build library system, you can use that as a frame of reference. One of the other things that we've had to do with a lot of organizations is to go through their deployment cookbooks and recreate critical infrastructure from scratch so that we have a good baseline to be able to compare it to. So it's, you know, hey, go configure one of these things to the way that we would deploy it if we had to redeploy it today. Let's take a snapshot of that. Let's compare it to what's in production. And then we systematically do what we call a reference node evaluation, where we evaluate each one of the systems in there, looking for variants. And then we can root out the highly critical servers and systems and network devices that have signs or symptoms of tampering, and we aggressively go after those to take them out of the environment and replace them with something that's hardened and that we can trust. You know, so once you've done that, you can start to systematically go through and take out the bad apples that are poisoning the rest of the barrel. And it's really difficult. It really takes a long time. The more systematic you are ahead of time, the easier this gets, because ideally you're detecting this variance and these issues early before they spread across your entire environment. You're able to know what good looks like so you can go back to good very quickly, and you have a process in place to respond to that. And that's one of the other things that I've seen organizations that are getting better at, is having a well-organized, well-planned, and rehearsed CERT, Security Incident Response Team, process, so that you know who to mobilize, you know how to keep people from having collisions and friendly fire problems where too many people are in trying to fix things, and you can have an orchestrated and measured response. You know, so that's really kind of the front end of this, is to isolate the environment, figure out quickly what highly critical assets have been compromised, and then put together an organized and orchestrated response. And then there are a bunch of steps that come in after that.
Right. Now, we've got Retro D and Psychops in the chat room who make a couple of very important points. As you were talking, I think I can feel the rage bubbling up in the chat room, because they know this. I mean, the IT people understand that, yeah, this should be planned years and years in advance. This plan should be ready to go. But as Sidechops points out, spending on this kind of security is not high on the executive's list. I mean, unless it's a piece of hardware that you'd say is the magic bullet and will fix all things, they're not going to authorize it. You've got Retro D saying, look, what do you do with a group of people who keep screwing up the fundamentals? What you're talking about are fundamentals of good security policy. Well, we know these things. So why is it, and I say this respectfully, why is it that we need someone like you to keep giving seminars about things that we should already know?
Well, again, I think something that shifted is the tone of the conversation. So in the old days, it was techie guys trying to get budget to do techie things. And now I think we've got an opportunity. You know, if your organization's anything like mine, your CFO, your COO, you know, business executives have an iPad. They probably have the Wall Street Journal on there. And every now and then, they probably forward you some high-profile breach story and say, oh, are we okay on this? Or do we got to worry about this? Each one of those things, and whether they email you or not, if you see a high-priority issue that you're worried could affect you, that becomes a good basis for a conversation with the business. And to try to talk to them about where the risks are, where the opportunities are, what your priorities are to be able to resolve some of these things. And, you know, ultimately, one of the things I talk about is that, you know, hope is not a strategy, trust is not a control. And then we need to figure out a way to make sure that the shape of our IT spending matches the shape of our risk. You know, so regardless of how much you're spending, you need to make sure they understand what the risk-based priorities are so that you can spend appropriately. And if you find areas where, you know, executives on the business side understand risk, a lot of them understand controls. So start to talk to them in their language about business impact, about risk, and about what expenditures could reduce that risk to an acceptable level. And then you can have a funding conversation, because it generally boils down to resources, it boils down to money, it boils down to maybe, you know, third parties that you can hire to help you with this. There's generally an answer for this, but it's not going to get funded unless they feel it in their gut. It's got to be a visceral response.
Dwayne, I think you just mentioned something that is absolutely vital. I think everyone listening to this show right now should remember and should tell all of your IT friends, and that is this idea of talking to them about the percentage of risk. What we like to do is we like to listen to a presentation like this, and we like to say, this is why you need to fund me. This is why you need to trust me so I can prevent this from happening. I think that never works. That's what we're used to doing. We're used to saying, wait a minute, why aren't you trusting me? If you hire me to protect you, why aren't you giving me the budget so that I can do that? I think what you're saying, Dwayne, and what I'm hearing is talk to them in their language. Tell the executives, look, I can get by on that budget, but if you want me to get by on that budget, you've got a 40% risk of this. You've got a 60% risk of this. Yeah. This we're not protected against at all. And those three stories that you sent to me, yeah, those could quite possibly happen here. So I'll do what you want me to do in the budget you give me. But if you give me the extra, I can start addressing these things. Is that the kind of conversation you're advocating?
Yeah, and one of the things that I've learned is that a lot of people who are involved in information security they don't have a lot of practice doing that. So what I would say is find an ally, find a coach. You know, it could be somebody in your chief legal counsel office that's used to taking really complex legal things and translating them into a business risk that people understand. They can help coach you, you know, and say, here's my story, here's what I'm trying to tell. Help me figure out the right words for this. Or if there's somebody in your controller's office that prepares, you know, management reports or board reports, they're used to taking, you know, huge amounts of data out of Excel and getting it down to a couple of you know, pie charts or graphs that generally go up and to the right in PowerPoint. And you know, they can help you net out a lot of the complicated world that you live in and take it down to something that the guys will be able to understand and act on, ideally in a way that favors your posture.
Now, Joe, we've got Merwolf in the chat room who makes a good point. He's saying, well, you know, every major breach makes that conversation a little bit easier. And Dwayne was just mentioning how you sometimes, I remember getting this, you get that forwarded email, or you get the forward to the link to the story about a breach with the tentative question, are we covered for this, or are we okay with this? That's kind of how we deal with breaches right now, right? I mean, it's just executives getting scared and saying, this could never happen here.
Yeah, I think that's the case. But I think some of the good news is, I think security is moving towards the storage and disaster recovery market, where years ago we would always talk about disaster recoveries after the disaster. And now that disasters are the new norm, now that Hurricane Sandy and other disastrous issues seem to be popping up more frequently, I think there's a more proactive stance on disaster recovery. And now that I think security issues are becoming the new norm, I think companies will get more proactive. I truly do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they have to, right, Dwayne? Because, I mean, there's only one way for this to go if you don't get more proactive, and that is it's going to get worse. Yeah. And it will get more difficult to reestablish trust if people see you get breached again and again and again.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that is, you know, unfortunately, this has to work, and you know, it feels like it's out of Office Space, but sometimes people don't listen to you, and you bring in a pen tester or you bring in a consultant to help kind of air your dirty laundry, and then maybe they'll get some action there. You know, sometimes people don't want to listen so much to their internal staff, and they will listen to an outsider, but I would recommend that you try to get that funded before you have a real problem.
Right, right. All right, Dwayne, I want to throw this back to you. We talked a little bit about the emergency actions that you need to take after a breach. We've talked a little bit about the cases that you've been involved, well, not involved with, that you know of, in which companies had to respond to a breach. Now, let's get really, really proactive here. What are the concrete steps that an IT administrator listening to this podcast right now should be taking? What are the things that he should be doing aside from preparing to have that conversation with the executives? What are the hits, the hints, the little tips that you can give him about preparing his business, his network for a breach?
Well, some of this gets down to there are best practices out there. If you look at, you know, it used to be the SANS top 20, now they're the Council on Cybersecurity top 20, or the NIST framework, which is very complex, but I recommend going for the top 20 approach. You know, start going through the list. You know, the first four deal with knowing what you have, being able to detect which configurations are secure, finding changes, and, you know, making sure that you know what applications and what hardware and software are on your network. You know, so a lot of that will help you. And then the next layer up to me is really getting a clean handle on the application access, the user roles, and, you know, kind of inventory what you have. Because one of the things we find is that a lot of times people discover things after a breach they didn't know were in place, whether it's an application that's been sitting around for a while, user roles that are inappropriate, old accounts that are sitting there. I mean, that upfront audit is definitely a best practice. Another thing is to try to, as much as possible, drive toward a set of standards, because then your life gets easier. You can start to manage things as, you know, herds instead of pets, and it takes the complexity of your life out of this. The other part is to make sure you've got a clear idea of what's most important to the business and that you've got a risk ranking. You know, one of the things I know you wanted to kind of forego the conversation with management, but best practice I've seen in a lot of organizations is to set up some kind of a risk and security oversight board. And this is where it's beyond IT. You're having a conversation with, you know, key stakeholders in the rest of the business to understand what are our risks. And, you know, to get them interested, you can cover risk beyond IT. You want to cover hiring risk. You want to cover third-party contract risk. You want to cover, you know, DR, traditional kinds of topics, you know, things that might affect revenue. There's a whole range of things that you can discuss, but part of that will always boil down to IT risk and being able to have a conversation where they understand your world and without having to learn your craft and understand what the risks are and the impact on them will be. That makes it easier to get some tone at the top, to get a project in place and to get some momentum moving down the road towards adopting these standards.
Right, right. Joe, what about you? So throwing over to you, I mean, because you do have experience reporting on these data breaches. You have, I know you've done your own research on how companies recover from these breaches. What would be the tips that you want to give to that IT administrator?
Well, I think the big one now is you can't act like a dictator anymore. I don't think the CIO can just hand down mandates on what applications can be used and can't be used. I saw let's call it a $300 million mid-market company try to outlaw Box and Dropbox and other cloud applications without giving any major alternatives out there. And the users revolted. They just went off on their own and started using all these third-party applications. And suddenly, not only was the CIO trying to secure his internal network, now he was trying to go chase down all these other third-party services that the employees were accessing. So I think the biggest tip of all is you can't just say no anymore. You have to have some informed best practices for your employees in terms of what they can use and why.
Right. All right, gentlemen, I want to do one last story, one last bit, because I think it's very germane here. I think it's something that we should talk about. When we think of data breaches, we think mostly of external threats. We think of something like a Target. We think something like TJ Maxx, where your network is actually getting attacked and someone from the outside is pulling data out of secured servers. But there's a much worse scenario, and that scenario is what happens if your data breach comes from the inside. Again, from Network World, we've got an article here talking about how they did a survey of about 693 IT professionals. And what they found was that 60% of those IT shops have no dedicated funding or plan to fight insider threats to data security. Now, we spend millions on firewalls. We train in intrusion prevention and detection. We even have a handle now on advanced persistent threats. But this is one of these things that I think no enterprise wants to even admit, much less fund. Let me throw it to you first, Dwayne. The insider breach is something that's incredibly to protect against because, of course, insiders need to be able to use the network.
Yeah, and this gets where, again, I may sound like a broken record on this, but it gets down to making sure that the roles and access is appropriate, that you know what normal is. Because if you suddenly see somebody grab, you know, a boatload of records out of a database where they really shouldn't be and they never have before, or you see access from, you know, people who never accessed your key database from home and they're now accessing it from home, there are things that will help you understand that you've got a problem on your hands earlier. You know, so a lot of this gets down to how do I figure out quickly whether this is abnormal, and if it's abnormal, I'm going to go investigate.
Right. Joe, according to the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, 5% of a typical organization's revenue will be lost to fraud that's perpetrated by that organization's employees. Now, they are calling this loss malicious behavior by privileged users. That's a nice way of saying people who were trusted to do something and now are doing something else. Gartner suggests 5 methods to combat these breaches. The first was tighter controlled use of shared accounts. So especially if you've got an admin account, it should be tied to a single person so that there's no culpable deniability of who used it. 2, investment in context-driven or time-limited super user privilege solutions. 3, the use of a super user privilege management tool. 4, managed privilege sessions. In other words, when someone becomes a super user, they have access to the internal network, but they lose the access to anything external. And 5, the granular monitoring of shared and super user accounts. So it seems to me as if what Gartner is trying to do is they're trying to protect against privilege escalation. Does that strike you as something that's even possible? I mean, again, when we start talking about regulating IT admins themselves, because that's, let's be honest, that's who we're talking about. You're talking about keeping keys from the people who have all the keys.
Right. So I think as you march in that direction, the addition you want to add there is the auditing. The auditing level. So even if you're worried about locking down all these user accounts, and even if you're worried about your IT folks still having some sort of superpower, as long as you're auditing all this, you're still going to find a smoking gun. Back to Dwayne's point about, you know, is this person typically in this database from home and then doing a major download? Or is that something in an audit that would turn up the suspicious activity?
Right, Dwayne. I mean, again, this seems like a no-brainer. I mean, that sounds like the things you should be watching for, which are, well, is this user in a place that he should be? Is that admin doing what she should be doing? Why has Susie been administrating this database for the last 15 days when she doesn't even work on databases? Those are the sorts of things that we should pick up on. That's the context-driven tools. But are there any non-technological, more human policy-based approach solutions for that internal breach?
Well, there are also things, you know, we talk about supervisory controls a lot in the audit world where you need to have people who oversee things and just periodically review things randomly. So it's not predictable. It's not necessarily even automated. You know, that can help a lot. Another part of this is, you know, when you find some of these third-party issues, they're generally more of a process problem than they are of a technology problem. You know, so a classic thing in a lot of SAP environments is the people who create accounts that get that pay people should not ever be able to get paid out of that. You know, so if you create a vendor, you can't authorize payment to that vendor because it prevents people from setting up fictitious companies and paying themselves. You know, so look at your processes, look at your policies. Are there, and again, it kind of gets down to the handoff thing I was talking about earlier. Are there places where there's a phase transition, where there's risk of someone, you know, doing something malicious? Let's sit down and whiteboard some of those, you know, paper trace some of the scenarios and rehearse them and walk through and try to, you know, think like a bad guy and see if there are any opportunities where you could do something that would break the system and allow you to do something you shouldn't.
Right. Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you both for contributing to this panel discussion. Breaches are something that we're going to be talking a lot about, so it's great to have one of the acknowledged masters of recovering from a breach on the show. I want to give you your chance to tell the Twilight Riot where they can find you. Joe, let's start with you. I know they can find you on TNT, but where else can they find the work that you do in the tech world?
Absolutely. So most recently, I was with Nine Lives Media, and the brands over there were The VAR Guy, MSP Mentor, and Talking Cloud. But these days, you can find me on SeekingAlpha.com, blogging about tech stocks, and just find me right on Twitter at Joe Panettiere.
Thank you, Joe. Always a pleasure to have you. We will have you back. Now, Dwayne, I got to say, thank you again for coming in. It's always great to have a guest in studio, especially a guest who is as well-versed in his field of expertise as are you. Can you tell people about Tripwire? Can you tell them about what you do? And perhaps you could also tell them where they can find your next webinar in case they want to see a bit more detail on recovering from a data breach.
Okay, sure. Tripwire, you know, we help people continuously monitor and reduce the attack surface of their environments to, you know, achieve and maintain compliance. There's a number of things, including scanning for vulnerabilities. But I think the best place to learn about us is at tripwire.com. We also have regular webinars there. I do one periodically on topics that are related to either retail breaches or to recovering from breaches. You know, there's a lot of different pieces of material there. You can also find my opinion out on our blog, which is tripwire.com/blog. I also have a regular column on HelpNet Security, and I write semi-regularly on devops.com. And those are places you can find me. And again, Twitter is the best place, at that Dwayne.
Dwayne Melanson, CTO of Tripwire. Again, thank you. Now, folks, I'm afraid you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the world. That's according to 99 out of 100 hackers looking for our data. But we don't just want to leave you out in the cold. We want to give you a little something-something for tuning in each and every single week. What we want to do is we want to give you a way to get This Week in Enterprise Tech on your device of choice automatically. If you go to our show page at twit.tv/twiet, you'll find a little drop-down menu that will give you the option to get this show downloaded in whatever format into whatever device you like. Do you want the audio version into your iPhone so you can listen to it on the drive home? We could do that. Do you want it automatically downloaded into your desktop so you could play it on your large screen TV when you get home? We can do that. Do you want it on your Android phone or tablet, your Zombie Zune? We've got it all there for you because, well, because we love you. Also, did you know that I'm on Twitter? Yeah, if you go to twitter.com/PadreSJ, that's at PadreSJ, and follow me, you'll find out what's coming in on every single episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech, as well as be able to find out what I do in between episodes. And that includes setting up for my other Twitch shows, like Know How with Brian Burnett on Thursdays, or Coding 101 with Shannon Morse, or Padre's Corner on Fridays. So follow me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. Also, Did you know that we actually do this show live? That's right. Every Monday at 2:30 Pacific time, you can drop by at live.twit.tv, and you'll see the pre and the post show and all the bloopers, all the things that we cut out of the downloaded episode. It's actually a lot of fun. It's part of the experiment that is Twit. We're not just about producing content. We're about being interactive. And that's why you should also be in our chat room at irc.twit.tv. You probably heard me call out to several of the users. That's because our chat room is filled with some bright engineers, with some funny, funny trolls, and yeah, just some all-around good people, including Chibert, who is supposed to be on vacation, but isn't. Isn't that just strange? Finally, I want to thank everyone here who makes this show possible, to Carson, my super producer, to Lisa and Leo, who are currently on their way to Hawaii, and to Brian Burnett, who, Brian, yeah, that guy. Aren't you taking place of Pirate Jason?
I know. I'm filling in for the poor guy because, well, This is what it looks like underneath his eye patch. If it would work. There we go. He has Mad-Eye Moody disease right now, and so he's suffering, and I'm just filling in, but good show, Padre. Why don't you put this much work in on know-how?
Well, because, I mean, no, I just can't. I just can't. I'm sorry. How much time did we spend on that? We are a strange studio. Folks, that's going to do it for us. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.